Welcome to this week's Casterbrus podcast with a K, available on Casterbrus, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and Audio Boo.
So yeah, it's a funny stage. Yeah, the ones who seem more powerful at the moment, people like China, who don't get involved, make very clear statements, and people are wary, you know, because you don't see how they act, because they don't need to act. I don't know, yes. Oh, God, what were we, 20 minutes in, we haven't even started.
It's terrible. Welcome, dear listener, to a very different Casterbridge podcast with a K.
20 minutes, which is the length of a He-Man cartoon rattling on about politics. You think about it, we could have watched a whole episode of He-Man and Skeletor in the time we've just been...
We need to do one of those little sort of messages for the day at the end, don't we?
Yes, we do, don't we? Not to let adults touch you in inappropriate ways and to drink our milk and a very wide range of odd morals that would come up at the end of He-Man.
are you doing the backup recording then? Is that all
Yeah, I think so. Okay. Yes, it's recording because we've been going on. I've got 11 megabytes of political crap recorded at the moment.
Oh, that's for the Christmas outtake. Do we do a Christmas outtake? Maybe we should.
There's a post-election outtake.
Podcasts. Send them an outtake tape.
Oh. So what was this? It's Doctor Who thing again. We keep talking about it, but I just don't see it on my television. Actually, that's a lie. I've been actually watching a little bit of it of late. I've been watching it on iPlayer, so it has been on my television.
Okay. Have we started the podcast, James?
Yeah, I guess we have. Well, you said welcome to the podcast.
I did, didn't I? I don't know.
So I'm guessing that people are listening.
20-minute intro of political discourse.
Well, then after that, you said welcome to the podcast or something.
Yes,
so
I did. Yes.
That's the breaker.
So welcome, yes, dear listener. I hope you found our initial discussions as boring as we did. We're here to talk about Doctor Who, as you know. And we're going to go through a few news items, and then we're going to break it back a little bit and do a face-off between...
John Pertwee, really?
John Pertwee and John Pertwee.
Yes.
They're two distinct eras, the Series 7 and then...
The straightish hair and the horrendously bouffant-permed hair.
Yeah, seven seasons, 8, 9, 10 and 11, yeah. So I've got a couple of things to talk about before then. First of all, congratulations to Doctor Who, specifically everyone who was involved with the Day of the Doctor, the 50th anniversary, which helped the show win a BAFTA yesterday evening. And it wasn't just any BAFTA, it was one voted for by readers of the Radio Times, or more precisely, Doctor Who fans online. I think it's probably safe to say.
Right.
Although An Adventure in Space and Time didn't get nominated for best, didn't win the Best Single Drama Award, David Bradley did win an award for his part in Broadchurch as Best Supporting Actor. I'm a bit disappointed with that because I think there were better supporting, not better actors, but better performances in the supporting actors category from the other nominees there. So that was a little bit of a, it felt like it was a bit token for him, which I think he deserves better than that, to be honest with you. However,
he might be listening to this and now looking at his award and feeling he's somewhat being cheapened by this cocky northerner.
David Bradley's from York.
Yes, but you are a cocky northerner.
So is he. He's from York.
Yes, but he might not be cocky. And you are a cocky northerner. It wasn't a comparative between him. It was a description of what you are. That's like saying a soldier and Hitler are the same type of people. They're both soldiers. They're both in the military, but could be very, very different people. Now, I'm not saying either of you, God forbid, are like Hitler, or either of you are even soldiers. But I'm just trying to say that I was making a personal comment on you. I was trying to insult / tease / insult you.
Yeah, I think we all realised what you were doing.
There. Good, good. Because I had a feeling my allegory was not taking me into good waters. So I'm trying to steer back, paddling with my little oar. So where were we? Yes, he's done. Well, good on him anyway. But yes, I think I know what you mean.
But the interesting thing about it, I find, about yesterday evening's awards, is that there was no Doctor Who personnel there at all to collect the award. Faith Penhale, who's a BBC Wales
head of drama, isn't she?
Yeah, head of drama. Marcus Wilson, who was producer on Doctor Who, but he's not anymore, and Nick Horan, who directed The Day of the Doctor, were the only faces at Drury Lane to collect the award. Mark Gatiss was in the audience, so I don't know. He would probably have been a better person to go up, really.
Well, to be fair, I mean, Faith Penhallow's done a lot because she's been running as executive producer, hasn't she, since Skinner left. I mean, they also got, the gentleman's name who's escaped me from Torchwood, who came in as, not Mitchin, is it? It is, isn't it?
Brian Mitchin, yeah.
Yeah, he's in. But as I recall, Penhallow's had quite a strong... has done a lot of work for Doctor Who. So in a sense, maybe it's kind of nice that she got a chance to sort of stand up there as well, because, and no offence to Stephen Moffat obviously being the chief face of Doctor Who, gets all the focus, but from what I hear, yeah, she does a hell of a lot of work.
Yeah.
And people don't notice perhaps her as much as they do Stephen. So maybe in a sense it's kind of good that it's not the you know, it's not the footballing squad that was up there.
Well, indeed, yeah. You get loads of people up for other awards, and they're like famous faces. Even for, although obviously there was no David Tennant for Broadchurch, but you could, you know, Arthur Darvill was up for Broadchurch.
Yeah,
among many others. It was a weird sensation. Like these three people had just turned up on stage to collect an award, and like if you didn't know who they were, you'd be like, "Who the hell are you?"
Well, that's the problem,
Stephen,
isn't it?
Stephen Moffat's taller than I remember.
Yeah, that's very true. Because I mean, people who watch the awards are looking for that little bit of stardust, aren't they? As well, so it was probably a little disappointing from that point of view.
Absolutely. It was a funny thing. But well done, Doctor Who faced off a challenge from Broadchurch, Breaking Bad, Gogglebox, Educating Yorkshire, and The Great British Bake Off.
Oh God!
The latter in itself seems to be some sort of achievement these days.
Well, I mean, Broadchurch was a hard contender because people sort of adored it. To say I wasn't so enamoured, but it was well produced.
It was well produced. I liked the I would have liked. Was it on weekly or was it nightly?
It was weekly.
It was weekly. I would have liked it to have been nightly, like Torchwood Children of Earth was. I think it would have worked better like that.
Yeah, I think it
would have been just more effective closing it down like that.
Yeah. I mean, I must admit, my slight problem was that I really didn't give a damn enough about the characters to stretch it over a few weeks. Mm-hmm. While if it had been weekly, it might have been a little more daily, it might have been more cohesive as a whole thing. So, yeah.
I think Arthur Darvill was really good in it, though.
Yeah, no, it was good. It was nice.
He was one of the more sympathetic characters, I think. I think the parents were both quite unpleasant, weren't they?
Well, I have a lot of time for Arthur Darvill, who I don't know. I don't know what he does. I don't know whether he's a soldier or Hitler. I don't know what he is, but he's not, because he seems quite a straightforward and nice guy on Twitter and the like, but I've just been watching, as I say, some of the old series 6 and 7s, and you know, just thinking how much Rory brought to the role, and so much of that is how he conveys Rory as much as what Rory says and does. And I think probably to a certain degree he probably imbued how they wrote the character as well, by the way that he played it. So yeah, I have a lot of time for him as an actor. I think he's really quite underrated.
He's got a good voice as well.
Hmm.
He's a good singing voice as well.
Oh, good on him.
Yeah, because I've seen you may not know this. He's in the West End at the moment, in the same show that he was doing in the United States, on Broadway. So we'll move on. Terence Dix, there's a name you don't hear too often associated with Doctor Who these days. It would be really interesting to get him back on the show. Do you think he could do a 45-minuter?
He's done enough novels, hasn't he?
Well, he has, hasn't he?
I mean, I'm talking post the Target Range, so it's not like he's not got his hand in writing new stuff.
Since 2005 as well.
Yes.
I'm just looking across at my vast collection of Doctor Who novels. I can't actually see it at the moment, but I'm pretty sure.
They're never particularly... He doesn't have the... credibility that he used to have for his novel work, but I must admit I've quite enjoyed some of the stuff he did for the New Adventures. Certainly there's he always carries quite a good pace, I always find. They don't sort of meander.
Yes, agreed. Well, he's appeared recently at a convention in Airdrie Library.
Right,
one of those mini conventions. There's a lot of this going on now. We have them locally here. There was one in Stockton a couple of weeks ago, which unfortunately I wasn't able to get to at the last minute. We just have a small convention. I'll tell you who was at that Stockton one as well. Frank Skinner was there.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
The Doctor Who star.
The new Doctor Who guest casting. Yeah. Anyway, Terence Dix was asked a couple of questions and was reported to say that he loved all the Doctors but felt the one who best summed up the spirit was David Tennant, which is an interesting thing to say when you're in Scotland.
How
do you feel about that? Would you call David Tennant quintessential?
Well, it was interesting because when the article came out, I was reading it. It was James Leonard, wasn't it, who wrote that, as I recall.
It was who?
James Leonard.
James Lamond.
Lamond, that's it. See, I don't know the Casterbras cast, but you and Brian, I just guess at their names. But I mean, his point was that he didn't feel it was, and I felt that he was too, I think, light and cheeky, not quite alien enough to be the Doctor, which is an interesting point of view. I don't know. I think it's hard because sometimes I think people are right. I mean, as James said, that the Smith is very close to sort of being quite quintessentially Doctor. And sometimes I think, is he a little too close to being a quintessentially Doctor in the same way that Paul McGann's character was initially written perhaps a little too close to a point where it starts to feel a bit like tropes?
Hmm.
You know, like Smith with his bad outfits that he loves, his sort of slightly eccentric waffling.
Yeah.
At the same time, I don't know. Maybe James is right. I can see why. I think Tennant was a very quintessentially Doctor. I think I can sort of see that because it depends on what you define as a Doctor, doesn't it? I mean, you didn't obviously pose this before, so I'm thinking off the top of my head. I would almost say that Smith is quintessentially the sort of Hartnell, Troughton, Pertwee Doctor. I would say Tennant is very much the quintessential sort of Tom Baker, Davison, Colin McCoy Doctor.
Right.
So I would say they are quite quintessential in two different eras.
Okay. That's a very good answer.
I thought so as well.
It's a very interesting answer as well, which we won't dwell on. We're going to move on. Philip Bates, posted an article recently.
Philip Leonard?
Not Philip Leonard. No, not him. could three fiction books give us Whovians a clue as to when Doctor Who Series 8 will air in the UK? Now, we already kind of suspect, given that we've heard from Ben Wheatley that his episodes are due to be ready in July. He thought they were going to air in July, but I suspect they're likely to be ready for July for the TV, the conventions and Edinburgh Festival kind of thing, as we've seen in previous years for Doctor Who, that they've used those two events to premiere new episodes. Obviously not last year, but in the year before and the year before that. I think that's what's going to happen. And young Phil has stated that three new books, Silhouette by Justin Richards, The Crawling Terror by Mike Tucker, and The Blood Cell by James Goss, are expected to continue the new series Adventures range and introduce Peter Capaldi's 12th Doctor to the medium. The expected release date is Thursday, 11th of September. Now, usually what happens is the series returns for a few weeks before the books come out, so this would kind of cement a 30th of August bank holiday weekend broadcast.
Yeah.
Which is kind of what we've all kind of been expecting, isn't it, really?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. I think that probably sounds right. The bank holiday as well seems sensible.
I personally would like it a little later.
I know you would.
More Dark Nights.
No, more Dark Nights, yes. Yeah. Curtains, not in your house.
Pardon?
You don't have curtains in your house.
Yes, we do.
The light just shines through.
They're more drapey, though. They're kind of wispy drapes.
You sure? I mean, I thought Northerners had very thick curtains. And then
we don't
very
need
thick,
very thick curtains.
Thick nets.
It's dark most of the time.
Duck motifs on the wall. Bad wallpaper. Dear. Hilda Ogden coming in from the stage left.
Yes. Yeah. Doing that little singing song thing.
She did, didn't she? Oh, yes. Those are the days.
You can watch classic Coronation Street on YouTube.
Can you?
Yeah, Gareth watches it quite regularly.
I must admit,
Facebook updates.
I watched the very first Coronation Street on YouTube, I think, at the time of the time it came up to his birthday, which is very weird. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it more than the sort of soaps you get today because it was a little less, you know, epic.
Yeah. Well, I remember it being much better when I was a kid, and it seems it was more just there was less of that whole youth aspect to it.
Yeah.
They've kind of added to a lot of soap operas in order to justify making them like issuing more regular episodes, I think. You know, in Coronation Street, when it first started, they had two sets and they could only use one at a time, two exterior sets.
Is that true? No, I didn't know.
Yeah,
that.
They could only use half the street at any one time. So one episode might be like the Rover's end and the other episode the Sean External of like the other end. Okay. Exclusive competition on Casterbus at the moment. We're really pleased about this and we hope that you will enter. It is your chance to win one of five codes that will unlock all of Humble Bundle's Doctor Who digital comics content, which is really awesome. You have until Friday, 23rd of May for this, but you would need to redeem your winning code before they take down their Doctor Who series on Tuesday, the 28th of May, because once they're gone, they're gone. Casterbus team members are not eligible to enter this. Unfortunately, James, sorry. now, the price of these comics, they are digital versions, but you'd be looking at over $70 for Series 1 and 2 of the IDW series.
Cool.
And the bundle also includes 10 unlocked Doctors in the Android version of Doctor Who Legacy. So if you click on the show note below and head over to that and have a go at entering, and we will be announcing the winners on Saturday, the 24th of May. So if you do miss out, you still have a chance to pay to view these, to download these. And it is for charity. Humble Bundle does work for charity. They've raised $38 million over 20 different charities and non-profit organisations since 2010. they're really popular. So do have a go at that, dear listener. Okay, so that brings us to the centrepiece of this week's Casterbus podcast with a K, dear listener, in which we pit the two Pertwees against each other. I don't mean John Pertwee and Sean Pertwee. I don't mean John Pertwee and his cousin Bill Pertwee. I mean John Pertwee and John Pertwee, the third Doctor's two distinct eras. Because they were very, very strikingly different. I don't think there's any... None of the modern Doctors have had that kind of distinction in their eras. I don't think any Doctor other than McCoy in the 1980s had such a difference between their first run and the later series. And I think probably only, you know, we call Charlton's later series the sort of like the monster era, but I think only Tom Baker really comes close in having distinct eras in his run as the Doctor. What would you say?
Yeah, no, I think I'd agree with that. Yeah, as you say, aside from McCoy for his, I agree with that. So, McCoy's sort of the it depends on how we argue this. Could be argued as the counter version, the mirror version of the Pertwee.
Well, so I've got going kind of light to sort of like dark later on, as opposed to starting dark.
Well, I was going to say great going to crap, right? Crap going to great, but yeah, we'll go with that. We'll go with that. That's far nicer. Yeah.
Yeah. So we've got that really very straight series 7, where the Doctor lands on Earth. There's a little bit of rough and tumble in Spearhead from Space. You've got the gurning at the end, for instance, when the Doctor deals with the nesting consciousness octopus in its tank. But on the whole, the series is very action oriented, very kind of adulty pitched. Whereas late the following series and onwards, things are a lot lighter with the introduction of Joe Grant and the Master. And you know, many people have compared Terror of the Autons and Spearhead from Space and said the latter's basically a rerun of the former, with the Master taking the Channing role. That's very true, but it kind of goes off in a different direction after that. And even with the Master, you do get some darkness, I find, in the later series, even though the I'm gonna say darkness, but you do get that kind of sinister aspect, and that's what the first series has. It's sinister, isn't it? There's this. Even though Inferno is the only one that's actually set in a dystopia, there is a kind of dystopic feeling that maybe it's the focus on the military. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I would say that the first series is different, but possibly isn't really Doctor Who. Maybe it feels almost like it's revolting against itself and trying to be something different, as if the flagging ratings and the worries of the budget means that they try and do a different show, mm-hmm. to a point where it feels a very different show. It there is a certain argument, I would say, that it lacks a little bit of belief in itself. It's played so straight that it feels almost a little embarrassed about what Doctor Who was prior to it. So I would say, you know, when by Terror of the Autons, you start getting a feel of the of a sort of a zest, a sort of more of a confident vibrance in what Doctor Who is about. And I'm not saying Doctor Who should necessarily be about going into space and polystyrene sets, but Terror of the Autons is a very good example. It's almost, you could argue, like Broadchurch. Broadchurch, in a sense, feels very serious because it deals with a horrendously serious matter and everything's deadpanned. So everything feels almost a lot more classy because it's played so straight. But when you play stuff straight, it's easier to be classy than when you try and do things a little different. And one could argue that the first series of John Pertwee riffs too much off the success of more downplayed serious dramas like Quatermass was than Doctor Who. So that would be my counter, I think, to Series 7.
Okay. Do you remember a few weeks ago we were talking about the... was it Derek Martinez? I can't remember now. And someone had said that they were really, really pleased with how Spearhead from Space turned out when they recorded it on film. Mm-hmm. And they thought that they might be able to get the budget to do the whole run like that and sell it to the US.
And
we spoke about this and considered how it might actually turn out. Like, Doctor Who would then have been international based on that series.
But would it have been...
Well, that's it. Do you think it would... Would it have lasted this long if it had been just that? Because it's a reformat, isn't it?
I would like to know, really. I mean, I know fans like yourself and maybe me, maybe not, really, really adore Series 7 for various reasons. But I would be very interested to see how people in the time, as much as now, because now it's very difficult because pacing and the way television is done is very different. It's very hard to get a very honest opinion of what they think of shows within the context of its era. But I always wonder how popular it really would be, say, compared to, say, the next season, Return of the Autons and the like. Is it? It is a lot. It's got longer episodes, so it means the story's a little more dragged out, bar from Spearhead from Space.
Yeah.
The pacing, therefore, goes slower as well. And as I say, there's a lot less humour in Series 7 as well. I wonder whether it is just the fans who really like Series 7, or whether it has if you gave it to sort of a more casual viewer to view the whole of Pertwee, whether it would stand up as popular with them as it does with fans.
Well,
and thus being the question of whether it would, on a mainstream US, you know, going down that route as a permanent thing, whether it would be too dry for a longevity that Doctor Who has carried, which I think a lot of it is to do with its eccentricity and humour over its sci-fi concepts.
I think you could certainly take two serials from it, from that run, Spearhead from Space and Inferno.
Yeah.
And I think you could put them in any other era of Doctor Who reasonably successfully. And, you know, Spearhead from Space has been retread not once but twice.
True.
I think Inferno is... Excuse me, I think it is a really... I've said this millions, hundreds of times on the podcast. I really, really love Inferno. I think there's so much to it. It was an absolute genius stroke, twisting it and splitting it up into that parallel universe. Something that Doctor Who hadn't really genuinely done up until that point. So I think those are two very strong serials from it that you could put in any other era of Doctor Who. I think, though, that's...
Could you? I mean, I could argue... I see your argument with Spearhead from Space. I mean, not just the four-parter, but as you say, it has been riffed upon a couple of times now, it's even very recently. Mm. But, you know, Inferno, as much as I agree with you, it does have, out of all of that series, that slight dash of dynamic, which is, you sort of get in Doctor Who. It's a little larger than life.
Yeah, yeah.
At the same time, it's a horrendously dark piece with, you know, a whole world dying. And not just, you know, seeing a whole world die, but characters that you've had established in that world left to die in quite a horrific situation. I don't think Doctor Who has, in some ways, ever been quite as dark as that.
Well, I don't know. I think Russell T Davies went close to it with Pete's World. That world was dying, wasn't it?
But it never actually specifically
died. We never actually saw it die. No, you're absolutely right. It didn't specifically die. But at one point, it was dying.
but it didn't specifically die. No. That, I think, to me is the difference, is you actually see them in the last moments when the Doctor gets away and they are there left with a world which is just about to burn in their faces and burn their faces. it's going to do both.
Well, that's an interesting thing, because that is a very dark thing. And we have that whole light and dark thing with Doctor Who, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people appreciate more maybe Series 7 and maybe the Hinchcliffe years than they do, say, Series 8, 9, 10 and 11 and the Graham William years.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, that is a truth, isn't it? In the sense that, I mean, while a lot of people laud the Graham William years, you know, the ratings are pretty good.
Yeah.
And in a lot of ways, you know, you see how Tennant and the like riff the Doctor more for his humour of that era, perhaps more than his seriousness. I mean, the way, say, Tennant plays a serious part of his Doctor is very different to how Baker would. But the way that, say, Tennant plays the eccentricity is very similar to how Baker does. The very wide smile, the very large eyes. So in a lot of ways, what is commercially popular with Doctor Who, and the same with the new series, I mean, people will sort of say, you know, I love Water of Mars. But, you know, you'll find a lot of people, the casual viewers, will enjoy the lighter episodes more than, say, the fans will.
Yeah.
You know, people sort of hate Love, and fans loathe Love of Monsters, but the kids loved it. A lot of the kids loved it. You know, it's a hard one. That's why I sometimes think that Series 7 is one of those things where the fans would dream that Doctor Who was more like Series 7. But if it was, as you say, and it became the way that Doctor Who went, it would die quite a quick death, because I don't feel it has that accessibility. It's a very cold series. But at the same time, if I was to swing it round, I would say, because we're talking about Pertwee rather than the rest of the show, I would say beyond Series 7, Pertwee's era starts to, for me, occasionally to feel very lazy. It feels, as much as I think Casey Manning's a lovely lady, and, you know, I know she's a Joe Grant's a very a fan favourite. I felt she was a very diluted format. She was a real step back.
Mm. Well, you can see that Letts, I mean, he said it as much, that he didn't like the format for Series 7 and that he wanted to change it. And it comes down, it becomes more of a show aimed at younger children than the series before, which was probably, you know, older children, kind of secondary school age children, whereas Doctor Who Series 8 onwards was, you know, you were going down to kind of 6 year olds, I suppose, in terms of tone. I always have trouble with certain aspects of the later series, but I would probably pick, Inferno aside, I would probably pick a lot of serials from the later series ahead of the rest of Series 7.
Yeah.
I mean, although the production values are horrendous, Carnival of Monsters is one of my favourites.
Right.
Again, The Three Doctors is a favourite as well.
Well, I mean, again, it all comes down to the individual, doesn't it? I mean, I think Three Doctors, as much as I want to love it, is very padded and lumbers.
They both have a kind of a psychedelic element to them, don't they?
Yeah, I guess so. They kind of feel a bit cheap. I mean, I think they'd certainly go back to what Doctor Who should be about, and that's variety. Mm. And that's what Series 7 doesn't really do. The tone for Series 7 is very consistent.
Yeah.
And so, as I say, you know, if you don't particularly like the tone of Series 7, you're probably not going to like most of it.
And Claws of Axos as well is another of my favourites.
Well, I mean, my favourites beyond Series 7 would be... as we've said before, Mind of Evil, which I think is the best story, say, you know, one of the best Doctor Who stories.
I think it's the best Master story, isn't it?
Certainly, yes, but it's definitely the best Master story. I do, if I'm going down your neck of the woods, I like Frontier in Space. I think it's very kitsch. It's a little pantomime, but I kind of like...
I haven't seen that for years. I need to watch that. I haven't seen that for years.
I like the epic scale of it.
Yeah, I love the scale of it. And I love the Earth government thing as well, that the whole way that's portrayed. They've done superb work although it's a very long serial, isn't it? 6 episodes long. And I mean, it's a 10 part story essentially as well, isn't it, when you factor in Planet of the Daleks. But the Earth that is portrayed in Frontier of Space is instantly created the moment they're there. You totally understand the world
Yes, it's a little pantomime and childish in the way that it's portrayed so far as the arguments go, although I'm sure people would say satirically that's not much different to real life, but it does feel a bit childish in
going back to our intro, isn't it?
Yes. It feels a bit childish that if that was transposed to say McCoy's era, people would say, oh my god, look at how childish Sylvester McCoy has got. It feels quite dumbed down in a lot of ways, but at the same time it works within the context of the story. But yeah, Mind of Evil is a favorite of mine. I have a soft spot for Death to the Daleks, which I know a lot of people don't, but I still think that's got a nice pace and it's different and it's a bit of a risk taker in some ways.
I haven't watched that for many, 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 many years. I felt it was a bit, I'm turning it to Tom Baker, a little hokey with the whole, you know, that sacrifice at the end and some of the acting.
There is a lot of. Well, I mean, people
are not,
said,
are they not Thals? Are they Thals or are they human?
No, they're humans. As you say, as you are alluding to, inadvertently or advertently, it is full of Terry Nation tropes and recycled ideas, which does weaken it. But yeah, I mean, I certainly agree. I don't think there's a variety in Pertwee's later stuff after Series 7, which makes it interesting. I think, you know, it's a funny thing. We sort of say that Joe Grant was a sort of a kickback away from the sort of progression. One could argue Series 7 was perhaps ahead of its time in the sense that Liz Shaw would be written far better now than she was allowed to be written back then. So maybe that was the problem. But then to be fair, you know, prior to Pertwee, the Girls was always offset by the fact that you know, we tend to think, you know, that Doctor Who being a doctor and a companion as a staple order, but it wasn't until Joe Grant that became the case.
Yeah.
Before that, it was pretty much always a trio, at least. So, in a sense, it feels that it's not so much a step back, because while you might get someone like Victoria or Dodo, you know, who weren't, smart characters particularly, who could scream and stuff, they were sort of offset by the fact that there was a male companion there as well. But by Pertwee, when I suppose you could argue UNIT offsets Joe a little, but by and large, I tend to feel that the relationship between the Doctor and his immediate companion is diluted with Joe Grant. She's written to be too needy, too almost like play school presenter. Her lines are almost like she's talking to children, which, as you say, was possibly intentional. But I think that to me weakens the show a lot for a lot of John Pertwee's era, is that the companion in Joe Grant, is to say nothing against the actress, but just the way they wrote her and this stupid idea that the companion can only be there to feed the Doctor lines, which was never the case beforehand. I think that's what's so funny. Both Letts and Dix have sort of made this comment that, you know, you only need one companion because you only need someone to say what's going on, Doctor. But you look at Zoe, you look at Jamie, you look at Ian, you look at Barbara, you even look at Stephen, to be fair to the character who I often have a go at. You know, they're not just what is it, Doctors. They're very proactive characters.
Yeah.
Even Ben and Polly, to a certain degree. So to sort of suggest that that's all the companion needs to be derived to seemed very derivative and quite damaging to the show in a lot of ways. But...
Well, it's certainly something that stayed for many, many years, isn't it?
It did. And
very,
you know,
beyond Harry and Sarah together, we don't have multiple companions, and I'm not counting the dog, obviously. You don't, because he's essentially a talking sonic screwdriver. You don't have the multiple companion set up again until the end of the Baker era.
No, exactly.
And since then, we've had it briefly, really. We only had like one full series of it, haven't we?
Yeah, absolutely. I thought it worked. I thought it was, as we said before, I think that was one of the strongest things about the Smith era was bringing Rory into the fold. But yeah, no, I agree with you. And even Sarah, I mean, I think to be fair or unfair to Sarah Jane Smith, is there's not a horrendous amount of difference in the way that she ends up being deployed to Joe Grant.
Tell you what. Let's stick with Sarah and let's flip our Pertwee.
Okay.
And rather than it being about Series 7 and the rest of the era, about Sarah Jane Smith and Joe Grant. and the difference in the Doctor between the two companions.
Right.
Because there is a distinct change there, isn't there? In the way he talks to her and the way he treats her.
Do you think that's a written change, or do you think that's a dynamic change? Because, I mean, obviously, as with Baker, Pertwee was a very, very dominant force within the show.
Yeah. I think it was natural. I don't think it was a written change. I think it was natural. Obviously, there's some characterization in there. But if we consider that there was another actress cast before Liz Sladen, who apparently John Pertwee wasn't happy with, and so Barry Letts recast, and the lady whose name escapes me at the moment, but she will be referred to in the show notes because it did come out a couple of years ago, who the actress was. She was a taller woman. She was a bustier lady. And perhaps John Pertwee preferred smaller actresses so he could appear. I think it was Elizabeth Sladen who said this, so he could appear like a mother hen.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, be sort of dominant over his little team. I think that was just something that happened naturally. Because there's so many shots of the Doctor looking down to his companion and talking to her in an almost patronising, condescending tone of voice, isn't there?
Yes.
And that's a very common theme throughout the John Pertwee years.
Yeah. Now, it's a difficult one because, you know, going the other way, I mean, I always wondered a little. I know the production team have taken it on the chin and sort of said it was their choice to change from Carolyn. But you kind of wonder again that she was quite a tall and authoritative character, not perhaps what maybe John would have been more comfortable with. So, yeah, with Sarah, it is a different relationship. But then at the same time, I wonder how much of that comes down, as you say, to the dynamic, not just with Pertwee, but with Sladen in the way that she acts. The way she is as an actress is a very different sort of actress to Katie Manning. And as I say, that's not a disrespect to either of them. They're just very different. So, I mean, her backstory about her being woman's lib and everything, apart really from the Time Warrior and, you know, some of the way the earlier stories used her, there isn't that much of her being a strong, progressive female than really any other female characters, because even Jo Grant would go and sort of deal with people and move the story along in her own independent way. It's really down to how they interact, I think, is different. And but by and large, especially by Baker, you know, Sarah Jane isn't that much different in her role and her capacity, as I say, as Jo Grant. It's just how she delivers herself, I think, is different, and that gives a different feeling. But which is why I think Harry was so important, because Harry gave Sladen's character something to riff off on the women's lib, because he was always such a traditional male, and as you say, the dynamic got away from this silly notion that you've got to have just this one companion going, well, what is it, Doctor? Which, you know, I think probably Baker and Pertwee is a little similar in that sort of role, that they, you know, they enjoyed being sort of quite dominating male characters and weren't too bothered about that being what, you know, that the companion was reduced to. Actually, it's probably not fair to Baker. I mean, Baker was a very big fan of Ian Marta and Harry Sullivan, so that's probably not quite fair on him. I think that's where Pertwee suffered, is that I think his dynamic with his companions was very derivative. And I always kind of felt even Unit was pushed back a lot, even though, as I know, as an actor, he was very warm to the actors and to Unit and to Levine and to Courtney. So I'm not trying to say he didn't want them. I'm just saying that I always kind of wondered if he wanted one of those to be more close to him as a companion, he'd have probably got it. He seemed to have that sort of strength that if he wanted Benton to sort of almost be on level with Jo Grant in the stories or Brigadier, he'd have got it that way. And they're always sort of kept a little peripheral. I don't know. It's all hypothetical, but yeah, I think that suffers. I think the later years suffer a little from the fact that, as I say, I think it'd have been interesting to see Pertwee working a little closer with the team than he does with the Unit.
It would have been nice to see them go into space as well.
Yes, I agree. I mean, the only one you get really is the three Doctors.
Yeah.
And that's
can't count that really, can you?
No, and it's not very true either. But yes, I agree. I mean,
Benton's okay. It's a Brigadier.
That I don't buy. And I think it is a shame. I think, you know, when you took the TARDIS off to different worlds, it would have been nice, especially because because almost like the new series, it was still fairly grounded in UNIT in the later years, even when he had our post three Doctors. You could have quite easily, you could bring in Benton for a story on the TARDIS with Joe or Sarah, or you could pull in the Brigadier, or you could bring in Yates, and you wouldn't have to have them there permanently. You could have them for one story, because quite often they're popping back to UNIT anyway.
Yeah.
Or even in an unseen way. So it's a shame that they didn't really sort of explore that a little more.
Well, similarly, it's a shame they didn't do more with the Master.
Yes.
Because you would get these various occasions where they end up working together to sort out the Master's ridiculous plan. but it's a shame they didn't... I mean, they did do a lot with the Master, really. You know, like they had that continuing series with him in every episode, or in every story. You had the whole, you know, him in prison for the Sea Devils. But... And, you know, him doing his various naughty things in space, such as in colony space and frontier space. But it feels like, you know, now, looking back at what we've seen since, it doesn't seem like it would have been too much effort to have actually put them together properly for a story.
Actually,
that is one of the reasons why I really like Alistair Reynolds' Harvest of Time, which does put the Third Doctor and the Master together for about half the book, at least.
Yes. Well, I've not read it, but I think, I mean, that's what where Schalke sort of did so well, wasn't it? Was finding a reason.
Well, yeah, indeed, yeah, yeah. Putting the two together, because they do work really well. Pretty much for any. I'm not sure how the Eighth Doctor and the American Master would have worked together.
No, well,
I think he was a little bit desperate by then, wasn't he?
I think also, to be fair, that it's very difficult to really know what to see how either of them would have worked, because they had so little time to really explore what they were in that film. I agree. I think I mean, it's one of the lovely things about Logopolis later on, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know that you do have that moment where you get them to work together, and it's kind of fun. So yeah, I think it's a missing, it's something missing, which I'm surprised that the new series hasn't capitalised on yet, or maybe it will next series. I don't know.
Maybe. So anyway, let's go back to series 7, and let's extrapolate. Okay, so you've got one companion who just lasts for a series, right? What if we, how could Jo Grant have worked in series 7? Could she have worked in series 7? Or would the Earth have burned because she in Inferno because she was too busy talking to Humpty?
Well, I think Inferno would have been a different one.
Would she have tried to get off with one of the Silurians?
I think by and large, I mean, apart from Spearhead, Liz Shaw's role does sort of diminish somewhat in the capacity that she was meant to be in. Hmm. So you could probably swap them round.
Well, she's still pretty strong in Ambassadors, I think.
Fair enough. But by and large, apart
from... as I was going to say, what use would Jo Grant have been in a space program?
Yes, true. True. I mean, I think, again, as I say, my problem with Jo Grant is that I just don't feel that she really added anything. I mean, she was meant to be espionage, but you never really saw that. At least if they'd given her, which they didn't at the time, and to be fair, they started to with Sarah Jane, if they'd given her a decent enough role that she could have a really good proactive use. In the same way Ace has, you know, Ace becomes that person where you want an explosion or a bit of action. You've got the fact that she's a gutsy, ballsy teenager who likes bombs to fall back on. Same with Leela. Yeah. Or, you know, with Sarah Jane, you've got the journalistic intuition, which makes her want to explore things. Or, you know, if they'd given her something a little more credible, I think she'd have been a little more than a cipher. And in the end, that's all she really was, a cute and well-played cipher. So she probably wouldn't work in Series 7 because, to be fair to Liz Shaw, they'd given her a background, which meant that she could be more than that. And without us rattling on against the new series, again, that's the problem with Amy Pond and, to a certain sense, with Clara, is that because they've got no established personal role in themselves, they just end up sort of being smart lines, ciphers with a bit of charm.
Well, she likes to make a souffle, doesn't she, Clara? Oh, no, hang on, that's not Clara, is it?
Oh, that's it.
That's one of the other ones.
Yeah, so, you know, you lose a bit of what they could be. you know, it's the same way that, you know, with Ian and Barbara, one of the reasons they worked is because you had science and history,
yeah.
which gave them a very good way to interact within the stories, either in the science aspect or the historical aspect. So Jo doesn't really have, she sort of floats in the same way, as I say, that Amy floats or Melanie floats, as I say, even Clara to a degree floats. I mean, even Martha worked because she was a doctor. Donna sort of worked because the whole point was that she did feel displaced. That was the whole essence of her character, that she yeah. didn't feel worthy of herself because she was just a temp, in her words. So that's
was she just a temp? Was well, she just a temp, though?
In what sense? The serious point was that it was just to reinforce the character, and that was the point, that the character felt ungrounded, unable to find a sense of purpose. So that was her character trait, so much so, you know, as having a job, not having a proper job became a character trait. Amy didn't have that. And the worst thing about Amy, you know, is that she starts to fall through some terrible tropes, like, you know, a successful female in that universe has to become a model. Mm. It's like she's got no experience or background, really, being a kissogram, and to suddenly become a famous model. It just felt like, well, that's what you, if you want to show a girl's doing well, she becomes a supermodel. Yeah. It's like, you know, if a guy's doing well, he becomes a footballer. And it just didn't work for me. So, yeah, I think that's the problem with Jo Grant, is that they just never gave her enough. They didn't seem to believe in her enough to give her something to establish her. And I think that came across. So, yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, they're both good. I mean, as I say, I think Pertwee's got a lot of stuff going for it. And I think one of the things that Pertwee's going for it is, as you say, that it is so different. That it's, you know, not just with UNIT, not just with the Earth stories, but the tone changes as well. And Pertwee, to a degree, changes too. But I do think, I think Series 7 probably, as I say, has the more credibility. Mm. Even if, as I say, I think commercially, I don't think it probably carries the fondness that I think casual fans would find in the later ones.
Okay, well, we'll finish this section off by picking a non-John Pertwee story that you think John Pertwee would work with.
A non-John Pertwee story that Pertwee would work well in?
Yeah.
Oh, that's an interesting question, isn't it? I think, funnily enough, just going at regeneration stories, I would think that Pertwee would be very good in Castrovalva.
All right.
I could see that working for him, you know, as if, you know, if that had been his regeneration story. You know, it's very odd to think of it because it's off world, but it's quite dynamic. There's a lot of, you know, Davison's very excited in it as well. And that sort of thing I sort of could picture Pertwee doing in a funny sort of way, although he'd be the one on the chandelier at the end, smashing into the Adric machine.
Yeah. The Adric machine.
I'm just trying to think of other ones, because Poe is such a dynamic and runaround doctor. It's hard to picture him in stuff which isn't in his era, isn't it? It's a kind of,
well, I was going to say Seeds of Doom.
Yes, Seeds of Doom, I could see, but then it is very similar. It is very much running along those sort of.
It is, yeah. It's that action adventure sort of. Like. Well, I think it's more. I think New Avengers, isn't it? It's
yes.
Totally new Avengers, but I think you'd work with that. What about modern era, post 2005?
Well, I mean, it's easy to sort of look at the sort of ones which are on Earth and sort of drop them into those, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
You know, I don't know whether one might argue the Sontaran experiment. Well, obviously, Rise of the Cybermen is one that you would feel naturally, but again, that's because of Inferno.
Probably,
and
yeah.
It's because it's sort of Earth-based.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say the Sontaran experiment. No, I wasn't.
Yeah.
No, I wasn't going to say that at all. I was going to say the Satan Pit.
Oh, that's an interesting one. I wouldn't have naturally, but yes, I could see that. Well, again, is that the frontier in space aspect coming into it? You know, landing in a cargo hold sort of thing.
Possibly, yeah. I was more thinking the face-off with the demon at the end, really. Or the face-off with the demon and the face-off with Satan being quite similar. Not obviously they're not actually similar at all, but like as a visual experience, they're quite similar.
Well, this is the problem, isn't it? Is that you? It's very it's a natural process, but we tend to look at, you know, what we see in one sort of type of story, and then you know, as they say, like stuff in Frontier in Space, and then transpose that into another story and say, well, he would fit in that because we're sort of seeing similarities in the stories rather than necessarily it being about his doctor, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's an interesting question. It'd be interesting to see what you, dear listener, think would be a good Pertwee story outside Pertwee's era.
Yeah, so do tell us in the comments.
Because we don't know.
No, we haven't got a clue.
Not a clue.
Not a clue. Okay. Well, do you know what time it is, James? I nearly called you Brian then. I am sorry. Do you know what time it is, James?
I don't.
It is recommendations time.
Oh, right. Okay.
It is. I haven't missed anything, have I?
I think that's fine.
That seems to have taken you by surprise.
It has, yes. I'm just trying to think because there was a fair few. I've been watching the beginning of Series 7 again this week.
Right, and, so this is Asylum of the Daleks.
Asylum of the Daleks, right. And Dinosaurs on a Spaceship. Mm-hmm. I enjoy them a lot more this time. I think that's always the case when you know an era comes to an end. You can appreciate the era a lot better in this way.
I did enjoy Dinosaurs at the time, I have to say.
Well, so did I, but I enjoyed it more. I find I enjoy Amy more, knowing that there's a sort of finiteness disposed to her existence. It makes her feel less frustrating. And Asylum, this could be another topic in itself, but Asylum sort of carries a slight pain for me in the sense that an ex-girlfriend of mine sort of reminds, Jean Louise Coleman reminds me a hell of a lot of her. And the way that ended was, I don't know, I always kind of felt I let her down. And there's a sort of resonance when I watch that and a sort of sadness when I, you know, at the very end of that, where she finds out she's a Dalek and everything, that sort of really touches me in a very personal way.
Was your ex-girlfriend a Dalek?
Oh, well, I don't know. Maybe let's not go there anymore. So maybe she's now. Who knows? But it's funny when you sort of get things which are very personal like that,
yeah.
which no one else would probably... wouldn't riff with anyone else, but riffs with you personally. So I find that quite a hard one to watch for that reason, but still very good in a lot of ways. And beginning feels a bit silly. But,
I think the beginning is... it's what we were talking about last week, isn't it? With the one with the creature... and the labyrinth, the name, the God Complex.
A God Complex.
How it should have been the end for those two characters, and it wasn't. Yes. And then, you know, they were back at the end of the series, but that was okay because they were the versions from the beginning of the series. And then we've got, you know, 12 months later, we've got them back again, and they're falling out. And, oh dear, and she's a model. And Rory's not. And then they get on a bus and everyone turns into Daleks. Like, what the hell are you on, Moffat? Is one of the thoughts that might have gone through your mind. I think it would have been better if it had just been a fresh start.
Yes, I agree. I mean, I'm not keen on that sort of aspect, as you know. So, and it weakens the episode. I do quite like their confrontation later on. I think there's some quite genuine moments in that, you know, with the whole, with them talking about how he feels that he loves her more. And I do feel her comeback is a bit weak. I don't think you can really find any comeback to 2,000 years protecting someone. So I think she wasn't quite as in such a strong high horse as she seemed to imply she was.
He must have been very single-minded to put up with that.
I know, that's mad, isn't it? But
it is, yeah. You'd be driven mad, surely.
Well, I suppose you're an Auton, so you're a different thing. I like the fact that he remembers, even though technically he shouldn't, and it's just glossed upon as usual. But it's very fairy tale. But I do like that exchange. It's quite a nice little bit of drama in a very action-paced story. So it's a good story. I like that. I like it a lot. So, yeah, I'd like to go back and say I would recommend a watch of those two in particular. I watched another one. I'm trying to think what I watched. He just tries to stretch over and see what he put back into his case, but he can't remember. Oh, I started watching Life on Mars again, rewatching
From the start,
yes, okay. After Prey, which I thought was a very nice turnaround in the end for Prey. Did you watch the end of it, episode 3?
Yeah.
I thought it was a very nice, you know, we won't go into it because it's still available on ITV Play if you want to go and watch it in its whole. But I thought the resolution was very well handled for all the characters involved. And, you know, one sort of wonders whether those sort of crying out against the inverted commas, the fat detective, might just have been best waiting to the very end and then deciding how the show treated her. And I think how it treated her was very smart.
Yeah, I think on the whole, I would agree with you. I'm a little bit uncomfortable with the parentage issue, though.
Oh, what, the very end?
Yes.
Yes, it felt like a bit of... There feels like there's a slight twist which has no playoff to it.
Yeah.
Nothing that can be done.
Other than to sort of cut some people out of this. It just feels uncomfortable. I don't think there was any need for that, really. We're not going too much into that for obvious reasons. Now, with Life on Mars, I really want to watch Life on Mars and Ashes to Ashes back to back. Have you done that?
I've tried, I think. To a certain degree, yeah, I did, because I rewatched it with family and they hadn't seen Life on Mars, so they got to see Life on Mars go straight through to Ashes to Ashes. So on a second, yes, I did. I did. I think the problem is that you can tell that it's not written. The resolution to Ashes to Ashes isn't what was necessarily in the mind. They've always said that they sort of had similar ideas, but they didn't nail it down till the last series of Ashes to Ashes. And you can slightly feel that if you watch the whole thing together, that there's stuff that doesn't quite gel with the final resolution. But it's a great series. John Sim is great in it. And, Philip Glenson is very, very good. I keep forgetting his brother, of course, was in Caves of Androzani.
Yeah.
Who now doesn't look very different to Philip, but at the time, you know, when he was very young, it's completely different.
The thing with Ashes to Ashes, I always remember the guy who shoots Alex is on the phone to someone, isn't he?
Yeah.
And you never find out who he's on the phone to.
Oh, I noticed that.
And I wanted it. I thought I'd guessed it right. That, because they said how it, when Ashes to Ashes came to an end, they said how it was all focused on Hunt. And I thought I'd worked it out that it was Hunt that was driving the car that knocked Sam over.
Yeah.
In the future. And he was somehow tied in with Alex as well. And it was him that he was on the phone to.
Well, I think...
To Hunt. In the first episode of Ashes to Ashes.
I think they missed out a lot in taking away from the time travel idea. I think the time travel, which even in Ashes to Ashes, the end of Series 1, infers... that it is all set in the same universe.
Yeah.
That what she remembers as a kid was actually Hunt, not that he was there.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was all linked. And there's a couple of things in Life on Mars, which again, the episode with, his name's escaped me from Life on Mars, from Love and Monsters, and is now in...
Mark Warren.
Mark Warren, yes.
Yeah. He's in a coma.
When he's in a coma, sort of infers again that... Yeah. There's sort of a resonation, and you sort of lose that as soon as it goes into the resolution of Ashes to Ashes, which is a kind of a shame, because I think maybe there could have been a sort of more interesting way to play off that, or certainly a way to explain it. I think in some respects the resolution to Ashes to Ashes is a little too quick to dot the I's and cross the T's, and could have been perhaps handled with a few more episodes at the end that could have perhaps made it a little more special. I mean, I still think a lot of the fans have got it totally mixed up, and they call it all the Geniverse. And I never got that impression from reading, what writers have said and looking at it and watching it all the way through, that this is all to do with Gene Hunt. I think, I get the impression that Gene Hunt was a fly that eventually sort of managed to turn itself into a spider in a world that wasn't his to control, but his presence was so big it influences it, which makes it a little more interesting. So yeah, it's a fascinating series. Rewatching it, as you say, I've said it before, there are books that were out on Kindle which have now hardbacked at the end of last year, which you can buy, which follow on the story of Sam Tyler post the second series of Life on Mars, which, while fans deride and say are rubbish, I don't agree. I think they're sort of very much in style. I don't think there's anything there which really which really is against the flow of the series. So I'd say they're worth a look if you want a little more of Life on Mars.
Okay, cool. Do you have any more recommendations?
Legacy, I would still say, is worth a recommendation.
Yes, you've been playing Delta Legacy a lot.
I've been playing it, and as I say, my list of characters are absolutely terrible.
In your opinion, or just generally?
They work really well.
Right, okay. And I now... I'm just going to allude to Casturbis magazine issue 2 here, and I looked at a screenshot in there for the Doctor Who Legacy interview, and I noticed that the screenshot you used has got Stormageddon in there.
I can't remember where I got the screenshot from. It's not from
It's not from yours, because I haven't got Stormageddon.
No.
Well, so I thought you had Stormageddon then. I was getting a bit annoyed.
No. Okay. I've got the one of the annoying children from Nightmare in Silver.
Oh, right, Artie.
The girl.
Oh, the girl, right, okay.
I've got, I'm trying to think who's on my team. I've got, from the same episode, Porridge. I have K-9. I have Vasta's girlfriend.
Jenny.
She's on my team. I've got Colin Baker, Sixth Doctor, which is not one of my favourite Doctors. And essentially just all sort of minor characters. One of the characters, the detective from the Angels in Manhattan.
The detective from the Angels in Manhattan?
I think it's the detective from Angels in Manhattan. I'm not sure. In the beginning. In the opening, I think it's him. I don't know. His character is beyond me. But they're really sort of useless. But they're a fantastic team. Because one of the things I'll say, if you've not played Legacy, one of the strongest thing to do in Legacy, one of the most powerful things, is to work out the characters which can swap colours. Because if you can do that, you suddenly can create character. You can create a massive salvo virtually every four turns.
Right.
But this is what I tend to do. One of them turns the greens to blues, and then straight after that, my other one turns the blues to reds. So you build up your colours in your screen. It's a very, very clever tactic. So, yeah, but they're all characters I hate, but they're very powerful in my team. I just think, you know, is Doctor Who trying to spite me there? I've got none of them. You know, I've got McCoy, but I can't use him because he's not good enough. I had Rory for a while, but he's had to go. Sarah Jane is pretty rubbish now. But, yeah, but there you go.
While I just work out what I'm going to recommend, I would just like to thank our growing listenership. James, somehow our listeners found the time to listen to the podcast over 4,000 times in the last week.
4,000 times?
Over 4,000 times our listener has managed to listen to the podcast, yeah.
See, I don't get it, because, you know, at the moment, there's no real Doctor Who news out there. We're space-filling, and suddenly, you know, it's just rocketing up. How can we deliver podcasts which we know are going to be good if you lot just keep listening to random ones?
It's a very good question, dear listener, and we really think you should listen to it, answer it. In the meantime, as I say, I don't really have a actual recommendation for you, or not an original recommendation, but having been talking about the Third Doctor, I do feel that it is within your best interest if you search out some really good Third Doctor literature, dear listener. And among those, I would recommend Harvest of Time by the esteemed science fiction writer Alistair Reynolds. I also think that... now, Paul Mars isn't to everyone's taste, but if you are a Paul Mars fan and you haven't read Verdigris, then do. And if I've mispronounced that, I apologise. But that is a very good Third Doctor book as well. Mm.
Good calls.
Yeah, okay. I'm glad you think so. Mm. And that does bring us to the end of this week's Casturbis podcast with a K. It's been quite a long chat we've had.
It is, isn't it?
Well, most of which you possibly won't hear.
An hour and 20 minutes.
An hour of which we were talking politics. So until next time, hopefully we'll have Brian back next week. And we have got a guest lined up for the next in the near future as well. But until then, it's goodbye from us.
Bye-bye.